This is live special coverage of the 2021 presidential inauguration. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Today, the 46th president of the United States will take his oath of office. Joseph R. Biden will become commander-in-chief just 1 hour from now. We've become accustomed to inaugurations steeped in history and tradition, and while this day has its share of both, and frankly promises a return to the kinds of traditions many Americans took for granted and longed for, it takes place under unprecedented circumstances. The ceremony will make history. Kamala Harris will become the first woman and the first person of Black or Indian descent to become vice president. Joe Biden, a longtime U.S. senator and former vice president, ran twice for that high office before succeeding in his third run for the presidency in 2020.
As Michelle just noted, the ceremony today makes history because of the grim circumstances under which it takes place as well. The country faces multiple crises. The pandemic that has claimed 400,000 lives, the subsequent economic crisis, leaving millions of people out of work, and a deeply divided country, a division stoked by conspiracy theories and lies about the outcome of the election that culminated in a violent insurrection just 2 weeks ago at the U.S. Capitol, the same place where Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will be inaugurated today. We will bring you the ceremony live. It's going to be getting underway shortly. You can listen across all of NPR's platforms, your local NPR station, the NPR One app. And today, you can watch a live stream of all of it at NPR.org, Facebook, and YouTube. We're going to start our coverage this morning with NPR White House correspondent Scott Detrow, who is down in the action overlooking the platform on the west front of the U.S. Capitol. Good morning, Scott.
Hey there, Rachel. How's it going?
It goes well. What does it look like from your perch? What do you see?
You know, this is the most normal this has felt this entire day. You have the platform filled with former presidents, congressional leaders, the family members of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Vice President Mike Pence is about to walk onto the platform. Hasn't felt like that for most of the day, though. There was an intense security perimeter, multiple layers of fences with barbed wire. I'm looking to the west and I see the National Mall totally empty. There are American flags there instead of people. I see National Guardsmen patrolling the perimeter. This is an unusual inauguration being carried out under the threats of a global pandemic and under the threats stemming from the attack on the Capitol 2 weeks ago. And here's Vice President Mike Pence, who is attending the ceremony. Of course, President Donald Trump is not. He's currently in the air flying to Florida.
And we hear the music.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Vice President of the United States, the Honorable Michael R. Pence and Mrs. Karen.
Ushering in Vice President Pence and the Second Lady Karen Pence. Of course, as Scott noted, President Trump not in attendance. I mean, this is a ceremony so full of poignancy. Every attendance and the void left by people who choose not to come, Scott. What does it mean that Mike Pence is here?
Well, it means that, as we saw under the most extreme circumstances imaginable 2 weeks ago, he is here to support the transfer of power. He and Donald Trump lost the presidential election. Donald Trump never conceded that out loud. He never specifically talked about Joe Biden as the next president in his farewell address today. But Mike Pence was presiding over that ceremony that was interrupted by an attack on the Capitol to certify the Electoral College vote. Mike Pence did that, and that seemed to cause a break from President Trump. And Pence is attending Biden's inauguration today. He did not attend President Trump's farewell ceremony at Joint Base Andrews.
We can report now that President Trump has landed at his destination in Florida. This, of course, as the inauguration is set to begin. Scott, can you lay the groundwork for us of what we're expected to see in this ceremony? As we have said, this is the place where the tradition comes to bear. We see little reflections of what is important to both Joe Biden and Kamala Harris in this moment as they choose their own symbols to represent today.
That's right. We are going to have musical performances from Jennifer Lopez, from Lady Gaga, from Garth Brooks. Joe Biden is going to give his inaugural address. He's going to be sworn in by Chief Justice John Roberts, of course. Kamala Harris is going to be sworn in by Justice Sonia Sotomayor. Harris is about to become the first woman and the first woman of color to be vice president. And Sotomayor was the first woman of color on the Supreme Court. And, the large Biden family Bible that he used for both of his vice presidential inaugurations is out there on the platform. Kamala Harris is going to use two Bibles, one that belonged to a family friend who was basically a surrogate mother to Harris growing up, Ms. Regina Shelton. The second Bible is once Thurgood Marshall's. He was the first black Supreme Court justice and somebody who Harris, throughout her life, has viewed as a political role model. So that's some of the personal on the ceremony today. And then Biden, of course, is going to give his inaugural address. And I think we're going to expect him to talk about what he talked about throughout his entire presidential campaign, the idea of trying to restore the soul of America, to try to lower the partisan tension and try to bring people together to deal with the enormous crises that the country is facing right now.
We have outlined all the ways in which this inauguration is historic. It is worth underscoring the significance of Kamala Harris's inauguration today. You nodded to it, but it is worth just taking a moment to recognize that as of noon today, the United States will have a female vice president, the first time in America's history.
That's right. If you look at, you know, the list of vice presidents, it's just an overwhelming parade of white men over and over again. Kamala Harris is a clear break from that. She is the first woman to serve as vice president or president. She is, as we mentioned, the first person of color.
Yeah.
It's going to be a big historic moment here. And,
all right.
And lots of people are upset that they weren't able to be there to see it in person.
Okay, we'll get back with you, Scott. I want to turn it over to my colleague, Michelle.
And I want to say I'm delighted to be here with my colleague Rachel Martin and the other NPR colleagues who will be supporting our coverage today. You've been hearing this all week. The security around this year's inauguration is remarkably tight following the mob invasion of the Capitol on January 6th. More than 20,000 National Guard troops are here in the Capitol to provide protection. We're going to hear more about that from Tom Bowman, NPR Pentagon correspondent, who is with us. And he is at Navy Memorial Park, one of two designated protest sites in D.C. today. Tom, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, at Navy Memorial and also right across from the National Archives. And Scott mentioned it's kind of normal on Capitol Hill. It's anything but normal here. Michelle, there's an 8-foot fence separating us from Pennsylvania Avenue. I'm looking out on Pennsylvania Ave, and no one is going up and down the street unless they're a police officer or Secret Service. I can see about a dozen police officers stretched out in front of the National Archives. I see a cluster of National Guard soldiers out there, and across the way, there's a big white security tent. But again, the only people who can go through there are police officers, emergency medical technicians. And there's another fence across Pennsylvania Ave. So basically, nobody can go down Pennsylvania Ave at this point.
You'd have to be pretty motivated to want to mount a protest, you know, at the moment. But clearly, some people are. So can you just talk a little bit about that? Who is actually out there? What do they have to say? Why are they there?
Well, we talked to three George Washington University students, Katie Thompson from, she's 20, from Atlanta. And she said she wanted to be here, and she feels it's kind of un-American almost to see this heavy security here. It's kind of too bad. They wanted to celebrate the Biden-Harris win, and they feel, you know, they're just kind of wandering around looking at all the security. And again, they feel it's kind of a letdown. It should be a more festive time here. Now, there were supposed to be two protests here, one right down at the Navy Memorial that I'm looking at right now, and another one just up the street at John Marshall Park. That's right next to the Canadian Embassy. Now, we're told both have been canceled at this point, so we don't know if there'll be any kind of pro-Trump protest here. I can see a guy right across from me. He's wearing a Trump flag, and he's on a scooter. But right now, the only people we see down here, you know, a handful of tourists and mostly press down here. A lot of photographers taking pictures of this scene on Pennsylvania Ave through the fence. And again, only security people, police, lining up and down Pennsylvania Ave through the fencing.
Tom Bowman, thank you so much. Rachel?
Thanks, Tom. We're going to bring in another voice to our conversation. Elizabeth Newman served as the assistant DHS secretary on counterterrorism. And she resigned her position not many months ago after she had served 3 years at DHS. She resigned saying that the Trump administration had diminished the threat from domestic extremism. Elizabeth, thanks for being here. We appreciate you today.
Thanks for having me, Rachel.
So here we are in this moment. Joe Biden, Kamala Harris to be inaugurated in the same place where rioters loyal to President Trump stormed the U.S. Capitol building on January 6th, attacked police officers, destroyed federal property. Some shouted, "Hang Mike Pence." 5 people were dead when it was all over. I mean, is this the kind of thing that you had tried to warn the Trump administration about?
Absolutely. Multiple people, not just me, but lots of my colleagues in the counterterrorism community could see that the threat was growing, that the president not only was refusing to take it seriously, refusing to describe the threat and alert the American public about it, but he was actually helping the threat. He was pouring fuel on the fire and bringing people that would, you know, maybe 10 years ago be people that we would consider just the normal part of society, bringing them into something very dark, feeding grievance and allowing them to be recruited into very dark extremist movements. Some of those movements are very obviously domestic terrorists, like the White Power movement or the anti-government extremist movement. And others are relatively new things that we're still grappling with, like QAnon and just this a big lie that the president has perpetuated for the last, really started since the summer. He sowed the seeds for this idea that the election was going to be fraudulent and it could be stolen from him. And then after the election, it was stolen from him. But we have 50 million Americans in this country that still believe that the election was stolen. They are going to watch this inauguration today and believe that Joe Biden is not the legitimate president. And that's a dangerous place for our country to be. And it was not just Trump ignoring the threat. It was Trump increasing the threat or creating the environment for which this threat could thrive. And Joe Biden is going to have a lot on his plate come his presidency to tackle this problem.
Let's pivot in that direction then. Looking forward, if you are the incoming President Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, how do you begin to, for lack of a better expression, put the genie back in the bottle? I mean, mm-hmm. How do they begin to combat this threat that has been able to grow exponentially over the past 4 years?
Well, I think the first thing is actually not something Joe Biden can do. I think we need credible voices from the right, people that supported Trump, to come out and explain to their constituents, to the people that listen to them, that this is not, the big lie was not true, that Donald Trump has been lying to you, apologize for their role in enabling it, and tell the truth that Joe Biden was legitimately elected. That helps our security forces shrink the number of people that could potentially be mobilizing to violence. So from a security standpoint, I think it's very important for Republicans to, with a very strong united voice, denounce the big lie that Trump has perpetuated. On the other side of that, hoping for the best there, recognizing that few Republicans have had the integrity to do this, but on the other side, I think that the Biden administration has demonstrated they are going to take this threat seriously. They look to be standing up a domestic terrorism task force. They've brought into their DOJ with Merrick Garland and Lisa Monaco, people with experience prosecuting and going after domestic terrorists back in the 90s. So you're bringing in people with the experience and relevance to this threat. And I believe that while there are a number of things that they're going to need to do, including alerting the public that this threat doesn't go away after inauguration, mm-hmm. I think we're in for a series of challenging times in the coming years of attacks. And we need to harden our targets and see something, say something. But more than that, they have the opportunity to look at updating our laws, look at changing some of the culture in our law enforcement and military structures that may have been turning a blind eye to this threat or may have actually been embracing this threat in certain places. There's a lot of work that they have in front of them, mm-hmm. but I feel very confident that they're bringing the right people in to get after this threat.
Elizabeth Newman, former Assistant Secretary on Counterterrorism at the Department of Homeland Security. She resigned from that post last fall. Elizabeth, thank you for your perspective this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Happy Inauguration Day.
Indeed.
Let us be clear that this is Joe Biden and Kamala Harris's day. And I want to mention that Kamala Harris, the vice president-elect, soon to be vice president, and her husband, Doug Emhoff, who will soon to be the first second gentleman, have arrived at the Capitol steps and are greeting their many, many, many well-wishers. And you can see that as experienced political figures, they're having a hard time not hugging people, and certainly people who want to hug them. But let's go to Ayesha Roscoe now, NPR White House reporter, who is also joining us, who's been covering President Trump for the last 4 years, and we'd like to hear from her now. Ayesha, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Noticeably absent, of course, from the festivities today will be President Trump, one of only a handful of presidents not to welcome his successor to the White House. He left the White House this morning and has flown to Palm Beach, Florida. Tell us a bit more, if you would, about his morning today and what his message was in his outgoing remarks.
Well, his main message in his outgoing remarks, it was kind of stunning. He had this event at Joint Base Andrews, where presidents typically fly off on Air Force One. But what he did, it was almost like a rally. He had music blaring. There was like this 21-gun salute. And then he came out. He did give this upbeat speech, you know, basically talking about what he felt like he had accomplished, but he also wished the new administration well, wished them success. But we can't leave out the context that obviously he's not going to inauguration today, and he pointedly, once again, did not mention Joe Biden by name. So there is a level of disrespect there, really, in not mentioning the incoming president. And so even as he wished the new administration well, we have reporting from my colleague Tamara Keith that he did leave a letter for Joe Biden, but publicly he would not say Joe Biden's name, and that is the way he left. And his final words as to the public as president was, "Have a good life, and he'll see you soon."
I want to mention that many of the customary courtesies President Trump ignored, did not welcome his successor to the White House. The First Lady, the outgoing First Lady, Melania Trump, did not welcome Dr. Jill Biden, the incoming First Lady, to the White House for the traditional visit. Of course, Dr. Biden has spent many hours in the White House and didn't really need that tour. But it was, again, a sign of disrespect, as you noted. As presidents, and I do want to mention that the outgoing Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, and his wife, Secretary of Transportation, Elaine Chao, who resigned, just arrived. And we understand that the president-elect, Joe Biden, and the incoming First Lady, Dr. Jill Biden, are arriving at the West Front. We expect them momentarily. Ayesha, while we wait for the Bidens to arrive, as presidents often do, there was a flurry of commutations and pardons last night, overnight, really. Which of those stand out to you?
Well, the one that everyone will be talking about is Steve Bannon. The decision to go ahead with that. Steve Bannon had been accused of, participating in basically a scheme to get donations to build a private border wall. But the decision to do that with Steve Bannon is once again the President Trump helping his friends, his allies, you know, because he had gotten back close to Steve Bannon, or at least become cordial with Steve Bannon again. And once again, he helps someone that he knows. And that's what a lot of these people who got commutations or pardons, the rapper Lil Wayne, Kodak Black, another rapper, they were people who had connections. Now, there were people who are regular people who don't have all these connections, who did get some commutations, people who were serving life sentences for drug offenses. So you did have some of those more common type commutations and clemency.
And here is President-elect Joe Biden and the incoming First Lady, Dr. Jill Biden. They have arrived, as you can see, to a very warm welcome. And here they are.
We're going to bring in NPR political correspondent Mara Liasson, who is watching this scene, a historic scene for so many reasons. Mara, I also see a little bit of some snow flurries coming down, if I'm not mistaken,
yeah,
through this shot.
Flurries.
Mara, I mean, you watch what's happening at the Capitol right now, and it's reminiscent of another time when you think about the division in this country right now. It's like a parallel world with the tradition we're seeing honored in this moment.
Yeah, I mean, this is a moment of tradition. This is a moment that communicates peaceful transfer of power, even though we didn't have one. We had a failed, violent attempt to stop the peaceful transfer of power. But you see the ex-presidents, obviously not Trump, but they are there to send a message that in America, we transfer power, sometimes from Republican to Democrat to Republican and back again, and we do
Mara,
it peacefully.
I'm going to leave you there. Here's Amy Klobuchar, Senator Klobuchar.
Vice presidents, leaders from abroad, and a whole bunch of Bidens. America, welcome to the 59th presidential inauguration, where in just a few moments, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will take their solemn oaths. This ceremony is the culmination of 244 years of a democracy. It is the moment when leaders brought to this stage by the will of the people promise to be faithful to our Constitution, to cherish it and defend it. It is the moment when they become, as we all should be, guardians of our country. Have we become too jaded, too accustomed to the ritual of the passing of the torch of democracy to truly appreciate what a blessing and a privilege it is to witness this moment? I think not. 2 weeks ago, when an angry, violent mob staged an insurrection and desecrated this temple of our democracy, it awakened us to our responsibilities as Americans. This is the day when our democracy picks itself up, brushes off the dust, and does what America always does, goes forward as a nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. This conveyance of a sacred trust between our leaders and our people takes place in front of this shining Capitol dome for a reason. When Abraham Lincoln gave his first inaugural address in front of this Capitol, the dome was only partially constructed, braced by ropes of steel. He promised he would finish it. He was criticized for spending funds on it during the Civil War. To those critics, he replied, "If the people see the Capitol going on, it is a sign we intend the Union shall go on." And it did. And it will. Generations of Americans gave their lives to preserve our republic in this place. Great legislation to protect civil rights and economic security and lead the world was debated and crafted under this dome. Now it falls on all of us, not just the two leaders we are inaugurating today, to take up the torch of our democracy, not as a weapon of political arson, but as an instrument for good. We pledge today never to take our democracy for granted as we celebrate its remarkable strength. We celebrate its resilience, its grit. We celebrate the ordinary people doing extraordinary things for our nation, the doctors and nurses on the front line of this pandemic, the officers in the Capitol, a new generation never giving up hope for justice. We celebrate a new president, Joe Biden, who vows to restore the soul of America and cross the river of our divides to a higher plane. And we celebrate our first African American, first Asian American, and first woman vice president, Kamala Harris, who stands on the shoulders of so many on this platform who have forged the way to this day. When she takes the oath of office, little girls and boys across the world will know that anything and everything is possible. And in the end, that is America, our democracy, a country of so much good. And today, on these Capitol steps and before this glorious field of flags, we rededicate ourselves to its cause. Thank you. It is now my honor to introduce to you the senator who has worked with me and so many others to make this ceremony possible, my friend and the chair of the inaugural committee, Missouri Senator Roy Blunt.
Now we hear from, as Senator Klobuchar said, Roy Blunt, Republican from Missouri, yet another of those traditions that we once took for granted, but which now seems remarkable. Two senators from different political parties sharing the lectern to have remarks. And here he is.
A touch of snow up here this morning. Of all the things we'd considered, I don't think snow was on my agenda until I walked out the door a moment ago, but thank you, Senator Klobuchar, and thanks to the other members of the Joint Congressional Committee on the inauguration as we officially begin the 59th inaugural ceremony. I also want to thank the Joint Committee staff and our partners, particularly our security partners, for the way they've dealt with unprecedented circumstances. When I chaired the inauguration 4 years ago, I shared President Reagan's 1981 description of this event as commonplace and miraculous. Commonplace because we've done it every 4 years since 1789. Miraculous because we've done it every 4 years since 1789. Americans have celebrated this moment during war, during depression, and now during pandemic. Once again, all three branches of our government come together as the Constitution envisions. Once again, we renew our commitment to our determined democracy, forging a more perfect union. That theme for this inauguration, our determined democracy, forging a more perfect union, was announced by the Joint Committee before the election with the belief that the United States can only fulfill its promise and set an example for others if we are always working to be better than we have been. The Constitution established that determined democracy with its first three words, declaring the people as the source of the government. The Articles of Confederation hadn't done that. The Magna Carta hadn't done that. Only the Constitution says the government exists because the people are the source of the reason it exists. They immediately followed those first three words with the words to form a more perfect union. The founders did not say to form a perfect union. They did not claim that in our new country nothing would need to be improved. Fortunately, they understood that always working to be better would be the hallmark of a great democracy. The freedoms we have today, the nation we have today, is not here just because it happened, and they aren't complete. A great democracy working through the successes and failures of our history, striving to be better than it had been. And we are more than we have been, and we are less than we hope to be. The assault on our Capitol at this very place just 2 weeks ago reminds us that a government designed to balance and check itself is both fragile and resilient. During the last year, the pandemic challenged our free and open society and called for extraordinary determination and sacrifice, and still challenges us today. Meeting that challenge head on have been and are healthcare workers, scientists, first responders, essential frontline workers, and so many others we depend on in so many ways. Today we come to this moment. People all over the world, as we're here, are watching and will watch what we do here. Our government comes together. The Congress and the courts join the transition of executive responsibility. One political party more pleased today and on every inaugural day than the other. But this is not a moment of division. It's a moment of unification. A new administration begins and brings with it a new beginning. And with that, our great national debate goes forward, and a determined democracy will continue to be essential in pursuit of a more perfect union and a better future for all Americans. What a privilege for me to join you today. Thank you.
That was Republican Senator Roy Blunt.
Please call to the podium a longtime friend of the president-elect and his family, Father Leo O'Donovan, to lead us in an invocation. Please stand if you are able and remain standing for the national anthem and the pledge to our flag.
And as Senator Blunt mentioned, Father Leo O'Donovan, longtime friend of the Biden family, will approach the podium in mere moments. We should just note that in between each speaker, an official is coming up to the podium and cleaning to make sure that all protocols are being followed because of the pandemic. And here we have Father Leo J. O'Donovan.
Gracious and merciful God, at this sacred time we come before you in need, indeed on our knees. But we come still more with hope and with our eyes raised anew to the vision of a more perfect union in our land, a union of all our citizens to promote the general welfare and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. We are a people of many races, creeds, and colors, national backgrounds, cultures, and styles, now far more numerous and on land much vaster than when Archbishop John Carroll wrote his prayer for the inauguration of George Washington 232 years ago. Archbishop Carroll prayed that you, O Creator of all, would assist with your Holy Spirit of counsel and fortitude the President of these United States, that his administration may be conducted in righteousness and be eminently useful to your people. Today we confess our past failures to live according to our vision of equality, inclusion, and freedom for all. Yet we resolutely commit still more now to renewing the vision, to caring for one another in word and deed, especially the least fortunate among us, and so becoming a light for the world. There is a power in each and every one of us that lives by turning to every other one of us, a thrust of the spirit to cherish and care and stand by others, and above all, those most in need. It is called love, and its path is to give ever more of itself. Today, it is called American patriotism, born not of power and privilege, but of care for the common good, with malice toward none, and with charity for all. For our new president, we beg of you the wisdom Solomon sought when he knelt before you and prayed for an understanding heart so that I can govern your people and know the difference between right and wrong. We trust in the counsel of the letter of James. If any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. Pope Francis has reminded us how important it is to dream together. By ourselves, he wrote, we risk seeing mirages, things that are not there. Dreams, on the other hand, are built together. Be with us, holy mystery of love, as we dream together. Help us under our new president to reconcile the people of our land, restore our dream, and invest it with peace and justice and the joy that is the overflow of love. To the glory of your name, forever. Amen.
That was Father Leo J. O'Donovan, an American Jesuit Catholic priest, the former president of Georgetown University and a close friend of the Bidens, particularly Senator Joe Biden. And I just want to mention he gave a little sort of fist bump salute to his heart as he approached the lectern. It's one of the many adaptations of the day. You can see this is a group of people who are very close and are used to expressing their fondness for each other in a different way. And due to the new
Ladies
COVID protocols, we will have the presenting of the colors in short order, the Pledge of Allegiance, and then we will hear the national anthem. And don't be alarmed, there will be at one point a cannon salute. Don't be alarmed by that. Here it is. You're hearing we are seeing the posting of the colors, the presentation of the flags. This is often a moment that people greatly anticipate. It's a moment of solemnity, but also a moment of celebration where the flag of the United States and the branches of the armed service are presented.
Solemnity indeed, Michelle. Moments ago, we saw images of National Guard troops during the invocation by Father O'Donovan, the National Guard troops, bowing their own heads, arms crossed, sharing in the prayer, a prayer that Father O'Donovan placed for unity in
Ladies
this country.
And gentlemen, here for the singing of our national anthem, accompanied by the President's own United States Marine Band, please welcome Lady Gaga.
I mean, a woman who really doesn't need an introduction, but we're going to give her one anyway. Lady Gaga.
With an amazing red skirt.
Amazing. We need to just say that because she's known for making an entrance. She's known for wearing a costume. And she's also known for some pretty amazing pipes. And we're going to get to see that on display, hear that in just a matter of moments. We're all waiting. Lady Gaga now approaching the lectern, and she will sing the national anthem, greeting the crowd as she approaches.
With a golden microphone, but because of course.
And she also has we're going to have to get clarification on what the pin is, but it looks to be a bird of some kind, a dove, the national anthem.
That was Lady Gaga with the national anthem. And you might be asking yourself, why Lady Gaga? Well, the members of this ceremony all have some connection to the Biden-Harris families or campaigns. And Lady Gaga is somebody who worked with President-elect Biden on the campaign to address sexual assault on college campuses during the Obama-Biden administration. Now we're going to hear from Andrea Hall, who's the president of the International Association of Firefighters. That was the first union to endorse Joe Biden. And she's the first African-American woman in the department's history to be promoted to the rank of fire captain in 2004 in her department in South Fulton. And here she is to lead the Pledge of Allegiance.
Fire Captain Andrea M. Hall for the reciting of the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Andrea Hall, president of the International Association of Firefighters, Local 3920, giving the Pledge of Allegiance, also signing along to the Pledge of Allegiance in that moment.
What you are all about,
Senator Amy Klobuchar,
part
again.
Of America, is a historic moment of firsts. To administer the oath to our first African American, our first Asian American, and our first woman vice president, Kamala Harris, it is my great privilege to welcome to the inaugural stage the first Latina to ever serve on the Supreme Court of the United States of America, Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the oath of office, followed by musical honors.
As a point of personal privilege, just seeing threads of my own life here, my father and my brother were both firefighters, and I am from Brooklyn, New York, as is Sonia Sotomayor, and the first
please
in my family
right
to attend an Ivy League school. So just as a point of personal privilege, here
Kamala
it is, the oath of office.
Kamala Davy Harris, do solemnly swear.
I, Kamala Davy Harris, do solemnly swear.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support and
allegiance to the same.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
That I take this obligation freely.
That I take this obligation freely.
Without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion.
Without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion.
That I will well and faithfully discharge.
That I will well and faithfully discharge.
The duties of the office on which I am about to enter.
The duties of the office upon which I am about to enter.
So help me God.
So help me God.
It's been a long time coming in this country, and with that, Kamala Harris becomes the first woman, the first person of color to become Vice President of the United States. She took the oath and then went quickly to her husband, Doug Emhoff, and embraced him. He becomes the second gentleman, the first second gentleman. Kamala Harris waving to the crowd there. Wearing purple, a color marked by the suffragette movement. I want to bring in NPR's Juana Summers. Juana, you spent a lot of time reporting on Kamala Harris. What are you seeing in this moment?
You know, the big thing I'm seeing in that moment is the legion of firsts that the Vice President Kamala Harris represents. So many people, so many women of color and people of color that I've interviewed for the last couple of years and covering her said they were hoping for this moment. She is a representative of a country that has grown more racially diverse after this difficult year in which this country has reckoned so powerfully with its own history of racial injustice. It's hard to overstate how significant of a moment this is today.
And with that, we are expecting another musical performance, this time by the artist, it reads Jennifer Lopez on the program. We know her better as J-Lo. And I think I heard the announcer say she'll be performing America the Beautiful. And J-Lo walking down the stairs, rocking a beautiful white outfit, I must say. Taking a moment to take in the scene. A lot of solemnity, but a lot of joy here on these steps this morning. Jennifer Lopez.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Islands, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went walking down that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. Oh, this land. Oh, this land. This land was made for you and me.
That was Jennifer Lopez, better known, of course, as Rachel told us, as J-Lo, singing This Land Is Your Land in a remarkable white outfit, very much sort of standing out. I just want to mention that it's just such an unusual mixture of emotions today, the traditional solemnity with yet some personal touches. You heard J-Lo speaking Spanish at one point, and you saw Vice President Pence reaching over to acknowledge his successor, Vice President Kamala Harris, after her swearing in. And here again is Amy Klobuchar, the member of the Joint Inaugural Committee on Inaugurations.
The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, John Roberts, to administer the presidential oath to the next president of the United States, Joseph R. Biden.
Ladies and gentlemen, please stand for the oath of office, followed by musical honors.
Again, we're waiting for Chief Justice John Roberts to approach the lectern where
Please
he will administer
your right
the oath
hand
of office.
And repeat after me. I, Joseph Robinette Biden Jr., do solemnly swear.
I, Joseph Robinette Biden Jr., do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute.
The office of President of the United States.
Office of President of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability.
Will, to the best of my ability.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
The Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. Thank President.
And with that, Joseph R. Biden becomes the 46th President of the United States. Here he is embracing his wife, Dr. Jill Biden. His daughter, Ashley, son, Hunter, also present. This has been a long journey for the Biden family. Michelle, Joe Biden has run for president twice before this successful campaign. I believe we have NPR's Ron Elving with us. Do we not? Ron, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good to be with you.
Put this moment into perspective for Joe Biden.
For Joe Biden, this is clearly the pinnacle moment of his life. He has literally been running for president for 33 years, even more. And this is the culmination of everything he has striven for. And yet, it's really not his moment. It is a moment more than any other presidential inauguration that I have witnessed that really belongs to a country in crisis and needs a president.
We are about to hear Joe Biden's inaugural address. This is something that a number of people are eagerly awaiting. He's taking his seat again.
It's a huge message. Quite. Unity is something that the Vice President, President Biden has talked a lot about in his campaign. And now in this moment, Ron, he's set to deliver words that have a lot of work to do in this country.
They do. And we will hear him speak of unity. We will hear him reach out. It will be in many ways the antidote to the speech we heard about American carnage 4 years ago. It will doubtless reach back towards the spirit of what we heard 12 years ago when Barack Obama took the oath for the first time. And as Joe Robinette Biden Jr. walked down the steps today and walked past former President Obama, Obama reached out and Biden reached out, and their gloves touched, and it was a sort of mix of high five and fist bump, and it sort of seemed to sum up their relationship and the way they had worked together over the years.
Again, those COVID protocols that we've heard so much about, wiping down the lectern between speakers, something none of us is used to, and clearly not the folks who are running this program either.
It is my privilege and high honor to be the first person to officially introduce the 46th President of the United States, Joseph R. Biden, Jr.
The crowd on their feet now. Senator Klobuchar with her hand on now President Biden's shoulder as he approaches the lectern
Chief
to give
Justice
his
Roberts,
inaugural address. Let's listen.
Vice President Harris, Speaker Pelosi, Leader Schumer, Leader McConnell, Vice President Pence, my distinguished guests, my fellow Americans, this is America's day. This is democracy's day, a day of history and hope, of renewal and resolve. Through a crucible for the ages, America has been tested anew, and America has risen to the challenge. Today, we celebrate the triumph not of a candidate, but of a cause, the cause of democracy. The people, the will of the people has been heard, and the will of the people has been heeded. We've learned again that democracy is precious, democracy is fragile. And at this hour, my friends, democracy has prevailed. So now, on this hallowed ground where just a few days ago, violence sought to shake the Capitol's very foundation, we come together as one nation, under God, indivisible, to carry out the peaceful transfer of power as we have for more than two centuries. As we look ahead in our uniquely American way, restless, bold, optimistic, and set our sights on the nation we know we can be and we must be. I thank my predecessors of both parties for their presence here today. I thank them from the bottom of my heart. And I know the resilience of our Constitution and the strength of our nation, as does President Carter, who I spoke with last night, who cannot be with us today, but whom we salute for his lifetime in service. I've just taken the sacred oath each of those patriots have taken, the oath first sworn by George Washington. But the American story depends not on any one of us, not on some of us, but on all of us, on we the people who seek a more perfect union. This is a great nation. We are good people. And over the centuries, through storm and strife, in peace and in war, we've come so far, but we still have far to go. We'll press forward with speed and urgency, for we have much to do in this winter of peril and significant possibilities. Much to repair, much to restore, much to heal, much to build, and much to gain. Few people in our nation's history have been more challenged or found a time more challenging or difficult than the time we're in now. Once-in-a-century virus that silently stalks the country has taken as many lives in 1 year as America lost in all of World War II. Millions of jobs have been lost. Hundreds of thousands of businesses closed. A cry for racial justice, some 400 years in the making, moves us. The dream of justice for all will be deferred no longer. A cry for survival comes from the planet itself, a cry that can't be any more desperate or any more clear. And now, a rise of political extremism, white supremacy, domestic terrorism, that we must confront and we will defeat. To overcome these challenges, to restore the soul and secure the future of America, requires so much more than words. It requires the most elusive of all things in a democracy, unity. Unity. In another January, on New Year's Day in 1863, Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. When he put pen to paper, the president said, and I quote, "If my name ever goes down into history, it'll be for this act, and my whole soul is in it." My whole soul is in it. Today, on this January day, my whole soul is in this, bringing America together, uniting our people, uniting our nation. And I ask every American to join me in this cause. Uniting to fight the foes we face, anger, resentment and hatred, extremism, lawlessness, violence, disease, joblessness, and hopelessness. With unity, we can do great things, important things. We can right wrongs. We can put people to work in good jobs. We can teach our children in safe schools. We can overcome the deadly virus. We can reward work and rebuild the middle class and make health care secure for all. We can deliver racial justice, and we can make America once again the leading force for good in the world. I know speaking of unity can sound to some like a foolish fantasy these days. I know the forces that divide us are deep and they are real. But I also know they are not new. Our history has been a constant struggle between the American ideal that we're all are created equal and the harsh, ugly reality that racism, nativism, fear, demonization have long torn us apart. The battle is perennial, and victory is never assured. Through Civil War, the Great Depression, World War, 9/11, through struggle, sacrifice, and setbacks, our better angels have always prevailed. In each of these moments, enough of us have come together to carry all of us forward. And we can do that now. History, faith, and reason show the way of unity. We can see each other not as adversaries, but as neighbors. We can treat each other with dignity and respect. We can join forces, stop the shouting, and lower the temperature. For without unity, there is no peace, only bitterness and fury. No progress, only exhausting outrage. No nation, only a state of chaos. This is our historic moment of crisis and challenge. And unity is the path forward. And we must meet this moment as the United States of America. If we do that, I guarantee you we will not fail. We have never, ever, ever, ever failed in America. We've acted together. And so today, at this time, in this place, let's start afresh, all of us. Let's begin to listen to one another again, hear one another, see one another, show respect to one another. Politics doesn't have to be a raging fire, destroying everything in its path. Every disagreement doesn't have to be a cause for total war. And we must reject the culture in which facts themselves are manipulated and even manufactured. My fellow Americans, we have to be different than this. America has to be better than this. And I believe America is so much better than this. Just look around. Here we stand in the shadow of the Capitol Dome, as was mentioned earlier, completed amid the Civil War, when the Union itself was literally hanging in the balance. Yet we endured. We prevailed. Here we stand, looking out on the Great Mall, where Dr. King spoke of his dream. Here we stand, where 108 years ago, at another inaugural, thousands of protesters tried to block brave women marching for the right to vote. And today, we mark the swearing-in of the first woman in American history elected to national office, Vice President Kamala Harris. Don't tell me things can't change. Here we stand, across the Potomac from Arlington Cemetery, where heroes who gave the last full measure of devotion rest in eternal peace. And here we stand, just days after a riotous mob thought they could use violence to silence the will of the people, to stop the work of our democracy, to drive us from this sacred ground. It did not happen. It will never happen. Not today, not tomorrow, not ever. Not ever. To all those who supported our campaign, I'm humbled by the faith you've placed in us. To all those who did not support us, let me say this. Hear me out as we move forward. Take a measure of me and my heart. And if you still disagree, so be it. That's democracy. That's America. The right to dissent peaceably within the guardrails of our republic is perhaps this nation's greatest strength. Yet hear me clearly, disagreement must not lead to disunion. And I pledge this to you, I will be a president for all Americans. And I promise you, I will fight as hard for those who did not support me as for those who did. Many centuries ago, St. Augustine, a saint of my church, wrote that a people was a multitude defined by the common objects of their love. Defined by the common objects of their love. What are the common objects we as Americans love that define us as Americans? I think we know. Opportunity, security, liberty, dignity, respect, honor, and yes, the truth. Recent weeks and months have taught us a painful lesson. There is truth and there are lies. Lies told for power and for profit. And each of us has a duty and a responsibility as citizens, as Americans, and especially as leaders, leaders who have pledged to honor our Constitution and protect our nation, to defend the truth and defeat the lies. Look, I understand that many of my fellow Americans view the future with fear and trepidation. I understand they worry about their jobs. I understand, like my dad, they lay in bed staring at the ceiling, wondering, can I keep my health care? Can I pay my mortgage? Thinking about their families, about what comes next. I promise you, I get it. But the answer is not to turn inward, to retreat into competing factions, distrusting those who don't look like you, or worship the way you do, or don't get their news from the same sources you do. We must end this uncivil war that pits red against blue, rural versus urban, conservative versus liberal. We can do this if we open our souls instead of hardening our hearts, if we show a little tolerance and humility, and if we're willing to stand in the other person's shoes, as my mom would say, just for a moment, stand in their shoes. Because here's the thing about life. There's no accounting for what fate will deal you. Some days, when you need a hand, there are other days when we're called to lend a hand. That's how it has to be. That's what we do for one another. And if we are this way, our country will be stronger, more prosperous, more ready for the future. And we can still disagree. My fellow Americans, in the work ahead of us, we're going to need each other. We need all our strength to persevere through this dark winter. We're entering what may be the toughest and deadliest period of the virus. We must set aside politics and finally face this pandemic as one nation. One nation. And I promise you this, as the Bible says, weeping may endure for a night, but joy cometh in the morning. We will get through this together. Together. Look, folks, all my colleagues I serve with in the House and the Senate up here, we all understand the world is watching all of us today. So here's my message to those beyond our borders. America has been tested, and we've come out stronger for it. We will repair our alliances and engage with the world once again, not to meet yesterday's challenges, but today's and tomorrow's challenges. And we'll lead not merely by the example of our power, but by the power of our example. We'll be a strong and trusted partner for peace, progress, and security. Look, you all know, we've been through so much in this nation. And in my first act as president, I'd like to ask you to join me in a moment of silent prayer. Remember all those who we lost in this past year to the pandemic, those 400,000 fellow Americans, moms, dads, husbands, wives, sons, daughters, friends, neighbors, and coworkers. We'll honor them by becoming the people and the nation we know we can and should be. So I ask you, let's say a silent prayer for those who've lost their lives and those left behind, and for our country. Amen. Folks, This is a time of testing. We face an attack on our democracy and on truth, a raging virus, growing inequity, the sting of systemic racism, a climate in crisis, America's role in the world. Any one of these would be enough to challenge us in profound ways. But the fact is, we face them all at once, presenting this nation with one of the gravest responsibilities we've had. Now we're going to be tested. Are we going to step up, all of us? It's time for boldness, for there's so much to do. And this is certain. I promise you, we will be judged, you and I, by how we resolve these cascading crises of our era. We will rise to the occasion is the question. Will we master this rare and difficult hour? Will we meet our obligations and pass along a new and better world to our children? I believe we must. I'm sure you do as well. I believe we will. And when we do, we'll write the next great chapter in the history of the United States of America, the American story. A story that might sound something like a song that means a lot to me. It's called American Anthem. There's one verse that stands out, at least for me, and it goes like this. The work and prayers of century have brought us to this day. What shall be our legacy? What will our children say? Let me know in my heart when my days are through. America, America, I gave my best to you. Let us add our own work and prayers to the unfolding story of our great nation. If we do this, then when our days are through, our children and our children's children will say of us, they gave their best, they did their duty, they healed a broken land. My fellow Americans, I close the day where I began with a sacred oath. Before God and all of you, I give you my word. I will always level with you. I will defend the Constitution. I'll defend our democracy. I'll defend America. And I will give all of you, keep everything I do in your service, thinking not of power, but of possibilities, not of personal interest, but the public good. And together, we shall write an American story of hope, not fear, of unity, not division, of light, not darkness, a story of decency and dignity, love and healing, greatness and goodness. May this be the story that guides us, the story that inspires us, and the story that tells ages yet to come that we answered the call of history. We met the moment. Democracy and hope, truth and justice did not die in our watch, but thrive. That America secured liberty at home and stood once again as a beacon to the world. That is what we owe our forebears, one another, and generation to follow. So, with purpose and resolve, we turn to those tasks of our time. Sustained by faith, driven by conviction, and devoted to one another and the country we love with all our hearts. May God bless America, and may God protect our troops. Thank you, America.
The 46th President of the United States, Joseph R. Biden, giving the speech of his career, saying, this country is ready for hope, not fear, light, not darkness. Ready for love, healing, greatness, and goodness. Michelle, I mean, we have to say this speech stands in such sharp contrast to his predecessor's speech.
So very much, Rachel. This speech is remarkable in part because of the moment and remarkable because of the contrast to what we heard earlier. This is about the generations to come and not the moment that we are in.